Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 111 of the Outlander podcast.
Why'd you make that face?
Well, I was trying to think if there's a shorter way to say that, and there's not. I was like...
111?
Triple one. 111.
I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So, Summer, what are we discussing this week?
This week, we will be discussing chapter 25, entitled... Raymond the Heretic.
You did that pretty well. So starting with the title, before we even get to the chapter proper, Connie, one of our listener contributors, writes, "What's a heretic? A person holding an opinion at odds with what is generally accepted, or a professed believer who maintains religious opinions contrary to those accepted by his or her church, or rejects doctrine prescribed by that church, or anyone who does not conform to an established attitude, doctrine, or principle."
Ellen G. also commented about the title. She said, "When you first see the word heretic, you might think apostate, dissenter, but looking into the word, other synonyms are nonconformist, freethinker, and that is what Master Raymond is."
Melissa shares, "First, this chapter is hard to read because this is not a third-person point of view. First person plants the reader firmly in the mind of a person who just lost their baby, and that is hard to read. Add to this Diana's excellent use of diction to create an overall tone of loss and emptiness, and the reader is transported to a very, very sad place. Diction? Word choice in this chapter plays a big part in conveying just how Claire feels as she lies there, sick and alone, in the l'hôpital."
It's about to get technical in here, you guys. We have a new listener, but a newish contributor.
Yeah, I think this is her second time. Mm-hmm.
Her name is Sarah, and she is an honest-to-God doctor, you guys. So this is what Sarah had to say.
"Some thoughts on Claire's loss from a physician's take. The signs and symptoms point to the diagnosis of placental abruption. This can occur from the 20th week of pregnancy and beyond. In the U.S., the frequency of this maternal complication is 1 to 2%, and most are classified as mild, but 25% are severe. Housed within the uterus, the fetus receives all its nutrients as well as oxygen from the maternal circulation via the placenta. This is the growing fetus's lifeline. In placental abruption, as the name suggests, the placenta separates from its connection to the uterine wall. Not only is the fetus at risk, i.e. no food, no oxygen, but depending on the amount and rate of bleeding, mom is at risk too. Interspersed throughout the previous chapters, the hints are there. Initially light to moderate episodes of vaginal bleeding and abdominal or lower back pain cramps. The exact causes are not completely known, but there are certain risk factors. Possible risk factors include maternal hypertension, whether chronic or because of preeclampsia, which is pregnancy-related high blood pressure. In fact, about 40 to 45% of cases have this risk factor. Though we have no way of knowing what Claire's blood pressures were, not a part of standard medical care in the 1740s, could it have been preeclampsia? Since Diana gives us no other information that suggests it, I cannot say one way or the other. 2. Smoking or cocaine use. Okay, I think we can safely say that was not the cause. 3. Uterine surgery, uterine fibroids, short umbilical cord. 4. Traumatic injury to the uterus due to motor vehicle accident, fall, or physical abuse. 5. Premature rupture of the membranes. The amniotic sac is disrupted. In lay terms, her water breaks. 6. Chorioamnionitis. This is an infection of the membranes enveloping the fetus. I suspect this may have been a possible factor. As we see in this chapter, Claire tells us, quote, I could feel the fever, an ache, and a chill deep in my bones that would burst into flame when it reached the surface of my skin. In earlier chapters, subclinical infection was probably brewing, and when it is subclinical, you would not have an outright fever at that stage. In the pre-antibiotic era, there really was no proven treatment. One hoped and prayed your immune system would overcome the infection before the infection killed you. Supportive care by trying to help lower core body temperature was beneficial, but the quote, remedies practiced at the time were most often not effective, perhaps even potentially harmful, for example, bloodletting, though on occasion some remedies may have been beneficial for reasons unknown. Sarah closes with, a discussion of this topic itself could go on for hours. So the chapter opens with Claire at L'Hôpital des Anges, lying in a bed or on a cot, looking up at the vaulted ceiling above her. She notices the detail and seems to concentrate on them. She noticed that her bed was under one of the double-crossing arches. She is surrounded by gauze curtains for privacy. And I wrote, okay, gauze curtains, how can that possibly be private? I mean, it's better than nothing, but maybe there were like 80 layers of gauze. What do you think? How many layers of gauze does it take to equal privacy? Is that like how many licks it takes to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop?
It's possible, but because they are, you know, in the continental area, I would say, like, what do they call it? On the continent?
Yeah.
It's because they're on the continent, I would say it was probably privacy. And
Well, privacy is in the UK. This
I know, but she's British.
This was
Claire's British.
Oh, yes, but so she's in France, so it would be
Claire's British. So it's going to be privacy. And I don't know what gauze looked like then. Gauze might have been much thicker, and it could have been thicker then. And then also, I'm sure she really doesn't care because she's out of her mind. And clearly, she doesn't care about her privacy. She lets Raymond come in and. Do all kinds of stuff to her.
Doodle her, yep. So she noticed that her bed was not placed directly beneath the architectural features. It was not centered. And this bothered her when she looked up. And then more of Diana's beautiful language. Quote, I kept wanting to move the bed by force of will, as though being centered beneath the roof would help to center me within myself. So Claire's off-center. She's not herself. Something is off. She's alone. Jamie is who knows where. Their baby is gone. Connie writes, if I had a center any longer. That was a quote. She says this harkens back to Master Raymond's discussion with Claire about healing in chapter 20 in his apothecary shop about helping Mary Hawkins heal herself. LNG also comments on this lack of center. The whole discussion reflects the whole chapter, a woman in need of balance. Has she really had it since she was torn from her own time? Did she even have it then? Now she's thinking of her imbalanced body. Not only is she seeking balance physically, but spiritually, not religious, as well. She describes what she feels like. Her body feels as if she's been beaten. Her joints ache. She was feverish. Even in the midst of her illness, she is a natural healer. She's making an inventory of her body, as she had when she was hemorrhaging at the Bois, and what was going on in a detached manner. We learn that Claire had been at L'Hôpital for 5 days. Connie writes, quote, the chill of the rainy dawn had settled in my bones. That's a quote from Diana. Connie asks, was this the morning of the duel or the morning here, this morning that we're experiencing with Claire? We were given many images of being cold and wet in chapter 23, Connie shares, as Claire was on her way to try and stop the duel. Apparently, she still carries this feeling with her, despite the ravages of the fever. Mother Hildegard is examining her, and Claire is sore. Claire had swollen lymph nodes, which she had felt herself. Of course, a sign of infection. Mother Hildegard utters a prayer, and Claire thinks she hears the name Raymond. She asks Mother if she means Master Raymond. And Mother is surprised and says, that heretical charlatan? May God protect us. Claire had thought she'd heard Raymond, and Mother says she was invoking the aid of Saint Raymond Nonatus. By the way, Summer, I think I mentioned this to you earlier, Saint Raymond Nonatus' feast day is the day that this episode will air, Sunday, August 31st. So someone had a little planning going on. Isn't that a little bit Twilight Zone-y?
It's definitely coincidental.
At least. So I looked up a little bit about St. Raymond Nonatus, and he was delivered by cesarean section or cesarean operation when his mother died in childbirth, hence his name Non Natus, not born. He is the patron saint of expectant mothers and midwives because of the nature of his own birth. Connie writes, he's also the patron saint on Call the Midwife on the BBC or PBS. Their house that they live in is called Nanata's House. It's the name of the residence where the sisters and nurses live and center their work. When Mother says she was invoking the name of Saint Nanatus, patron saint of expectant mothers, Claire says, of which I am no longer one. And this hurts Mother as well, and it reflects briefly across her face. So do you think that this, obviously it's a terrible experience for Claire and Jamie, whom we don't see at the moment, but do you think that this experience kind of brings Claire and Mother Hildegard a little, regardless of what just happened, a little closer in a way?
I think trauma definitely lends itself to that. Not just this kind of trauma, but any kind of trauma. Like, you know, you have a shared experience that's something that, you know, you don't ever not have. So, I mean, it's like you have this moment where the two of you experienced it together and you'll always have that. But it definitely, it is something, some horrible thing that they now share. Melissa says, Claire correcting Mother Hildegard, like someone who experiences such loss, the reader is given no chance to forget what has happened, and they are given no luxury of hiding from how it feels. Claire faces it, still wrapped in the disbelief that it has happened, and she can't forget it, so neither can we.
So yeah, I mean, she's in the L'Hôpital, you're not going to forget why she's there, so you're not going to forget what happened.
She hasn't been able to leave yet.
I know.
It's like an experience that hasn't stopped. I mean, you can't leave it. I mean, until you can leave that place, because honestly,
you can't heal. Heal.
No, you
can't. Forget physically,
well, you're still
mentally.
In it.
Yeah,
you're
exactly.
Still in it, and you can't get away from it. So, I mean, this horrible experience of what happened is technically still happening.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not out of it yet. And as far as they know, she may not come out of it. They mm-hmm. don't think she's going to.
Mm-hmm.
So, if nothing else, you know, it's like, it was this horrible thing that happened, we shared it, and now you're probably going to die. So I'm trying to, you know, temper all of these things.
You can see what friends they have become, not just both healers, but both out of the ordinary in their own way. They don't really fit in, but as healers, they each find their place. Claire's miscarriage brings the two of them closer in an unfortunate thing that, like you said, they're still experiencing.
Is it a miscarriage or is it a stillborn?
So the loss of her child brings the two of them closer in an unfortunate but somewhat beautiful way. The fact that they can, you know, that they're still friends and it kind of brings them, you know, a little closer together. When Claire shivers when Mother mops her brow with cold water and Mother says that she would suggest that Claire take help where it can be found. This is interesting because she wouldn't want help from Master Raymond, even though he could, but Mother's like kind of saying like an opposite thing. Connie points out that we will hear this again in later passages and books. Sometimes, Connie shares, non-believers ask for, quote, good thoughts, and believers may offer prayers. I would take Mother Hildegard's advice and accept all goodness and support that came my way. I think a lot of us would. As Mother leaves, Claire hears the sound of jet rosary beads clacking against each other. Connie writes, Mother Hildegard is wearing jet rosary beads. The last time we heard of a jet rosary, I believe, was when Jamie rescued Claire at the witch trial. In the book, It was the rosary Colm had given Claire. So Claire closes her eyes and sees, quote, faint lights in the fog, brief cracklings like the scatter of sheet lightning on a summer horizon. Do you think this means anything, or is it just beautiful imagery? I was thinking about it. I didn't want to look too deeply into it, but...
You didn't?
No, I really didn't. I just asked a question, so I'm curious, but I didn't look anything up or think much... too much of it. Before she leaves, Mother gets Bouton to stand guard over Claire and to keep her company, if you like. Connie writes, Bouton turned three times Widdershins. And this is Ginger's slight interruption of Connie's comment. Wittershins actually is a cognate from German Wider Sinnig, which literally means against sense or to go against something that is sensical. Connie continues, as though taking the curse off his resting place. It means counterclockwise, and in literature and superstition, sometimes going counterclockwise leads to a disappearance.
Hmm.
Exactly, huh? I wonder... Yeah. Diana writes, quote, with no child to lay in my arms, she had given me her own best substitute. And this is true. Mother has no child, but Bouton is the closest thing. She leaves him with her to keep her company. Connie shares, this alone, if nothing else in DIA, would endear Bouton to readers.
Mm.
Claire notes that Bouton helps remedy the chill of her feet, and Diana uses the phrase, quote, marble chill of my feet. Claire compares Bouton at her feet to the dogs at the feet of the kings carved on the lids of their tombs at Saint-Denis. Connie writes, photos of dogs carved on tombs, she shared a photo. She says, I think this idea could catch on again if people still had fancy tombs carved, having an image of your pets with you in death. Connie also points out that Saint-Denis is the patron saint of Paris and is a cephalophore.
What?
And she, exactly. She's like, look it up. I'm like, okay, I will. So a cephalophore is a saint who is depicted in art as carrying their own head. This typically means that they were martyred through beheading. Melissa continues, reference to Saint-Denis and the tombs there. I visited there. It is akin to a graveyard with all those dead kings. This is chilling. Claire knows she has an infection, but is numb from the grief and can't bring herself to care. She expects to die, and she feels like she's one step in the grave. Continuing with the chapter, then Bouton, quote, emits a small popping dog fart and settled into sleep. I love that Diana keeps humor in almost all things. And this is...
It was just so random, though. Like, it was one of those moments where you're like, what?
I know.
Wait. You read it like two or three times, and you're like, she didn't just have a dog fart at her feet of a woman who's dying.
So, yes, I'm listening to the very
dignified
sounding Davina, who mentions a popping, not just a dog fart, a popping dog fart. And I'm like, wait, record scratch, what? It was so... Like, wait, Davina just said popping dog fart? So, way to go. I mean, that's the way you get Davina to say something like that. So, it just sounds so dignified. I was like, oh, that just interrupted my, like, sweet, sad description of this terrible thing that Claire's going through with a dog fart. A popping dog fart.
I wonder if Diana writes these books and says, one day Davina's going to have to read this out loud. I'm going to throw something in there. One thing in every book that... She's going to be like, do I really have to read this?
Well, this is book two, so I wonder if she was thinking like that because this was so long ago. I don't know if Davina read it that quickly.
Well, maybe it wasn't personally for Davina, but thinking someday.
Later books, maybe.
Someday there's going to be an audiobook of this, and someone is going to have to read Popping Dog Fart. You should name this episode Popping Dog
Fart. Oh, no. That's never going to happen. Never, ever. So I like it that Diana, and hopefully, dear listener... /dear reader, you go on, if you haven't read all the books already, you do go on to read all of the books that we have and those to come, because one of the things that I appreciate about Diana in her writing is that she's an excellent writer. This is not about her skill of writing.
Understatement.
But, oh yeah, exactly.
She's an excellent writer.
No, understatement of the, yeah, of my life. But she keeps it real. She keeps it It's real life. Like, you'll be laying in bed with someone and being all hunky-dory, and then someone emits a fart. Or
nope.
Someone does a...
Never.
I'm talking about in the books, not in your life.
Oh.
But here she is, and talking about how she's on the edge of death, and she has infection, and people are trying to help her, and she lost her baby, and it's so sad. And there's a popping dog fart. So, Diana keeps it real. You know, when you're sick, and you're feverish, and peripherally aware of things, things can seem odd or real. Maybe even, like, hyper-real. So I wonder if this dog fart seemed, like, overreal? You know, truly even more real than real. And then, I don't know what's funny, the popping dog fart? Or then she continues with Claire. Then, I drew the covers over my nose and tried to do likewise. I love that even in her illness, she has the presence of mind to avoid the dog fart.
She's like, I'm not dead yet.
Courtney W. writes, I remember this chapter stood out for me the first time I read it, starting with the interaction between Claire and Mother H. Mother H., always so practical and logical, shows Claire her tender side in the face of Claire's devastating loss. Her gesture of leaving Bouton with Claire speaks to her deep affection for Claire, as Bouton is the closest thing to an intimate or child that Mother H. has. This passage, like all of Diana's work, never indulges in the melodramatic. Even as it addresses terrible loss and Claire's possible death, Diana includes, quote, a popping dog fart, and Claire pulls the covers up over her nose, keeping it real and humorous as always. So Claire goes back into sleep, into fog, into dreamless dreams of barren places. When she wakes, Bouton is gone. Connie asks, does it strike anyone else odd that he should desert her and not sound the alarm when Raymond arrives? I mean, maybe. I was a little bit curious as he was suddenly gone.
Clearly, Raymond is magic.
That's true, he is. Melissa writes, in her dreams, quote, loss pursued her, Claire, like a, quote, demon. This suggests that subconsciously she is processing these feelings, feeling what she doesn't want to. Demon is a powerful word as well, painting a picture of her loss as a monster relentlessly chasing her down. In all this stillness of her lying in a bed sick, her mind and emotions are actually working feverishly. In fever dreams, she points out. But Raymond's hairline is there. His forehead like, quote, a block of stone. Now, I highlighted this, which, of course, you can't see, so I'm going to point it out, because I found a few mentions of stone, which I will come back to. So, quote, a block of stone. That's the first mention of stone. Connie says that Raymond's hairline reminds her of Draco Malfoy's father, Lucius Malfoy, in Harry Potter, as played by Jason Isaacs. And can I just say that for many people, Summer's shaking her head, no, Ginger, you can't say. Well, you know I can. And many people, including myself, Jason Isaacs was our perfect Black Jack Randall forever. Since I began to conceive of this, just picturing him in my head, he was perfect in The Patriot. And then stars had to go and cast Tobias Menzies, and Ginger was done for the end. It's been, yeah. So I still love Jason Isaacs, but yeah, Tobias is like, yeah, no question. Ellen G. writes, what I do think is interesting is that there are no thoughts of Jamie at the early part of the chapter. Having Mother H. there looking over Claire, in Western medical fashion, whatever it was in the 18th century, while praying to Saint Raymond, brings to Claire's mind Master Raymond, and poof, there he was. Like Summer says, magic.
I thought poof was going to be the dog fart.
I don't think Raymond emits poofing dog farts.
You don't know that.
He is magic, so. Maybe he's so magic.
His don't pop, they poof.
Oh my gosh. Claire sees the lines of his forehead, and their movement looks like letters, quote, written just below the surface of the stone, trying to burrow their way to the surface so that the names of the dead could be read. Again, mention of stone. Connie says that the lines and furrows of his face seem like a palimpsest. Diana doesn't use this word, but it fits perfectly. I learned this from the All Souls trilogy, and I'm like, hey, Connie, way to pimp our other podcast. The All Souls podcast, which follows the All Souls trilogy by Deborah Harkness. And yes, we too learned that word through Deborah's books. So shout out to Deborah.
It's true, but the first time I read that, I actually had to go and look it up because I was like, is that a real word? Is that a real thing? Or did she just make it up?
Huh?
It does sound fake, so I had to look it up to see that it was actually a real thing because you don't think about it. And the way that it's used in that book, it's, you know, it's a magical thing, whereas opposed to, it was a real thing where they would, to reuse paper, they would basically use some sort of a chemical to clean the paper, and then they would write over it again, so... Palimpsest.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only pronounce that because of Jennifer Ikeda.
Yes. I was convinced that in another moment, my name would be legible on that white slab, and at that moment, I would truly die. And then, Claire screams. Melissa writes, here she finally exhibits some reaction and screams in fear. So we know that she doesn't truly want to die. It is interesting that it's Raymond who brings out this reaction. But with Mother Hildegard, someone with whom she was emotionally closer to, she experiences no emotion. This is one example of some sort of tie between Claire and Raymond.
Well, she clearly has a different kind of a tie with Master... I'm going to call him Raymond because
whatever you
don't
want to
do what you do.
It's okay. You do your own thing, girl.
I do. It's all I do. They have a totally different connection. They have... There's a spiritual, otherworldly kind of a non-traditional healer connection that she and Master Raymond have. And there's, you know, more of a just generalized, we heal people and we're tough old broads that she has with Mother Hildegard. So it's like there's two completely different types of relationships.
Mother uses this as an excuse to throw him out, that Claire doesn't want him there. She tries to pull him away, but he resists, quote, like a stone gnome in a lawn. Yes, it was about a gnome in a lawn, but the word stone again. Reference to Raymond and stone. Even with another sister's assistance, they aren't able to move him, so they lifted him up bodily and carried him away, his shoe dropping, quote, from one frantically kicking foot as they took him away. Claire, in her fevered state, concentrates on this shoe. It acts as a sort of anchor for her mind. So earlier in the chapter, when she's looking up at the ceiling, kind of like the order of the architecture, the order, how night, geometric shape and order, and it kind of, her mind rests. It's like an anchor. Now we see the shoe is something she can concentrate on. It's some sort of anchor. Takes her outside of herself. It settles her mind outside of what is going on in her body and emotionally. And this anchor is able to pull her gaze back, quote, from the impenetrable darkness of the inside. She felt as if she allowed herself to enter the blackness, her soul would be sucked out into chaos. As her eyes, now think about that word chaos. We do come back to it. As her eyes rested on it, she could, quote, hear again the sounds of the time passage through the circle of stones. She grabbed the bedsheets and tried to hold on so she wouldn't lose herself. So I don't know if you remember, but one of the words in the books, not the show, that one of the ways, and she has very few words for it, but in the description of what it was like for her to go through the stones, she mentioned something akin to chaos, the screaming, right? But it was like a type of chaos. Melissa shares, once again, there is an interesting juxtaposition of the feeling of movement slash chaos with nothing slash stillness. She stares at it to keep her mind from, quote, impenetrable darkness of the inside of her mind, and she doesn't want to fall into the blackness or be sucked out into chaos. Quote, she could hear the sounds of the time passage through the circle of stones. Raymond appears and suddenly she hears the stones? Another example of a tie to Raymond she has with no one else. More dreams that aren't still, where the beginning of the chapter was about stillness and nothingness, with Raymond's appearance, movement begins. An arm shot through the drapes and grabbed the shoe. Then she was able to concentrate on a face suddenly. With a hand over her mouth, she knew she was no longer asleep. That was Raymond telling her to be silent, to be still, so he will not be discovered, and she nods her assent. His fingers smelled like ammonium and sulfur, and I wonder if that's important. Well, Sarah, our physician friend, writes, I can only speculate what he is doing. Since antiquity, ammonia inhalants or smelling salts were used to arouse consciousness. It does so by stimulating an increased heart and respiratory rate, which subsequently increases blood flow to the brain's arousal center, thereby waking you up. Okay, next there is a reference to sulfur. It certainly does have some antibacterial properties, though Master Raymond would not use such terminology. He may have washed his hands with a sulfur compound, or he could have administered some to Claire. I can't say with any certainty from the text.
He could have just eaten a hard-boiled egg. Just saying.
Come on, Sarah. Why do you gotta make it difficult? Why do you gotta get all technical on us? Just say, hey, girl. He had a friar's gown over his apothecary's robe.
Sorry, you said friar, and I know you meant like Friar Tuck, but I'm thinking like
egg fry. I mean, deep fryer. Summer's hungry, y'all.
Clearly.
He throws back the sheet and opens her gown, exposing her. He cups her breasts, all of this in a businesslike way. Claire thinks of a woman she was in training with at Pembroke Hospital who had said the size and shape of a man's thumbs were a sure indication of the quality of his more intimate appendage. And she's thinking this as she's observing him and his hands and his thumbs, and that's how it came to mind.
Which, this is like one of the weirdest... What is it? What? Not a segment. Like, sections. One of the weirdest, like, sections, like, of this, in this chapter and of this book is just... having that happen and her make that statement about men's thumbs, and then what happens, what he does next, I'm like, just... Because it put me... It totally takes your mind into all these different places, so you... It's very clinical, and then all of a sudden she thinks about a guy's hands being referential to the size of their something else, and then, no, we're supposed to be clinical again, so it was hard to keep going back and forth with that.
So Claire, like Diana, well, hello, duh, she is Diana. Diana is Claire. Diana's all of them. Claire can find humor in the most odd, awful, non-humorous situations, but isn't that how our minds work, especially when we're sick? We find... If not the same kind of humor, we think of weird wackadoo things sometimes.
I don't use that word.
Wackadoo?
No, weird.
Oh.
I'm just kidding.
Thank you for that. Melissa writes, interesting anecdote about thumbs and their connection to male genitalia. Smiley face. I take this as a sign that Claire was already feeling better and her mind was slowly coming back from the abyss. Melissa continues, okay, here begins weirdness that I connect to how Claire healed Jamie at the end of Outlander. It is just as much mental as it is physical, with an inherent understanding of the human body that borders on magical. Claire shivers and says, Jamie. Raymond tells her, hush, Madonna. She shivers again. Her heat seemed to pass from her to him, but his fingers didn't warm. Melissa adds, just saying Jamie's name causes a physical reaction in Claire. There is such a powerful connection between them. The loss of his presence probably compounded Claire's physical slide. It isn't too surprising that he would be key in her healing. So when Claire describes, quote, the afternoon light was dim through the thick gauze of the drapes around my bed, we have the answer. The gauze drapes were thick.
There you
go. This is where I was wondering at the beginning of the chapter. She sees the shadows between Raymond's fingers weren't black and dingy, but appeared to be blue. Her fever left her body, her mind cleared. He pressed her slightly harder, urging her to lie back. She observed, quote, a faint flicker of colored light that seemed to move over his hands, shedding a glow of rose and a pallor of blue across my own white skin. Melissa, again, writes, Raymond's hands give off a blue light. Blue as a symbol conveys many things. Water and its healing, cooling properties, peace and spirituality. Courtney W. shares, and Master Raymond, categorically misunderstood and repulsive to everyone but Claire, goes to considerable effort and risk to treat Claire in his unorthodox but effective way. She trusts him. They are kindred spirits, herbalists, healers, outsiders, firmly dedicated to their crafts as they navigate the social and political machinations of 18th century Paris. The blue light is introduced here, which we see again in subsequent books, as it relates to healing and people from other times. Ellen comments on the healing work that Raymond was doing. When I do energy work, my hands get very warm, and I don't touch the body of the person I am working on. He was sending healing energy to all parts of her body, blood and organs alike. And Ellen points out, and still no mention of Jamie. Summer, I cannot wait to see what they do with this. Of course, they don't have to include it, but since it has to do with her healing, and since it's mentioned in pretty much every book after this, I hope they keep it. And I, by that, I mean the the blue light special.
I know, I was going to say, blue lights mean things, mean different things for lots of different areas. And at Kmart, it's a special.
There you go. I think that's that might be our title.
Blue light special.
There's a few in here that could work.
Popping dog fart.
No, never.
Come on.
He followed this up by going to her arms, down to her wrists and elbows. Her soreness eased, and she again thought she could, quote, see briefly a faint blue line within my upper arm, the glowing ghost of the bone. She says, the oddest thing about all this was that I was not at all astonished. It seemed an infinitely natural thing, and my tortured body relaxed gratefully into the hard mold of his hands, melting and reforming like molded wax. Something that I loved in Diana's description was the dying bacteria. Quote, I could feel the tiny deaths of the bacteria that inhabited my blood, small explosions as each scintilla of infection disappeared. And then we have the first description of what Claire will come to do as she does her own internal inventory, as it were. Quote, I could feel each interior organ complete and three-dimensional, and see it as well, as though it sat on a table before me. There the hollow-walled stomach, here the lobed solidness of my liver, and each convolution and twist of intestine turned in on and around itself, neatly packed into the shining web of its mesentery membrane. The warmth glowed and spread within each organ, illuminating it like a small sun within me, then died and moved on. I am so, so happy when Diana's knowledge of anatomy marries her God's gift of description and storytelling. Some of my favorite passages are these, when she describes with such beauty and elegance the normally not so sexiness of internal organs. I mean, who writes so beautifully about organs? I don't know. Does reading about internal organs make you this happy? Ellen G. shares a part of her own journey with us. I have been on a journey to fully understand the energetic side of healing. I began my journey taking Tai Chi, learning about the movement of energy in one's own body. I then undertook learning Reiki, and I have a master level in that healing style. Then about 12 years ago, I began looking into pranic healing. Both Reiki and pranic healing are 20th century movements with roots in ancient China, Japan, India, etc. I don't see auras on other people, but I can feel their energy. I know when people don't feel well, when they're depleted, etc. So when I read what Master Raymond was doing, I was so intrigued. And those last two words, so intrigued, are in all caps. I was intrigued too. It's, yes, he's physically touching her, so he's, quote, physically healing her, or at least he has a physical link while he's doing it. But it absolutely is mostly energy. It absolutely is his power, his ability, but absolutely has to be related to energy. Raymond's hands moved to her belly and stopped. He seemed to be listening. She gasps and moves involuntarily as one of his hands cups between her legs and then eases inside her. The inflammation subsides slowly. Then Diana writes, quote, now he touched the center of my loss. And she means the cervix, right? I don't think the cervix was still open, but I'm thinking the cervix because it was her womb.
I didn't even take it that far in my brain. I'm just thinking... His hands are up there.
Got it.
I'm thinking it's like, you know, when you go and have your yearly, and they kind of palpitate the area.
Yeah.
Feeling for, like, your ovaries and stuff. I'm just imagining he's all up in there.
He is all up in there. Maybe that could be the title. All up in there.
All up in there, popping dog farts.
No. This causes her more pain. His other hand is on her belly. Again, some beautiful description from Diana. Quote, he was still then, holding the source of my pain between his two hands, as though it were a sphere of crystal, heavy and fragile. Phew, that's a little hard to read. She just lost her baby, Jamie's AWOL, and she's being healed in this insane yet beautiful way by Raymond. Summer just cocked an eyebrow or two at me.
I've only got two.
An eyebrow.
I'm pretty sure I can only cock one of them.
No, I thought you moved the other one. I don't know why that doesn't. You can't control them both.
I mean, I can move them both up, but
try the other one. I can make mine dance, but that's okay.
All right, show off.
Not
show. I'm not showing off because I'm not. Can, this is not a video.
It's not even like I can move both my eyebrows. I can make them dance.
Well, the reason I say dance, they don't. It's still muscles. Like I don't take them off and put them aside and say dance, babies.
No, I'm just saying there's a level of that's just a whole another level of
show what, off.
Yeah, it's not just that they move. Because for instance. I move. I would never call myself a dancer.
Oh, no, I can't dance.
But apparently your eyebrows can.
I can make them dance.
I mean, I can move, but you can't make me dance.
Oh, goodness. Okay. Basically, I can move them. I can synchronize their movement to music that I make with my mouth.
Why your mouth? Can't you do it to external music?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you're very much pigeonholing it to music of your mouth.
Because that's where I first did it.
Which implies they only dance to your own tune.
That's how I started or taught myself to do them separately. Okay, let's go on.
So Sarah, our physician friend, again writes, after delivery, if the uterus remains flaccid or atonic, the bleeding will continue. The uterus must resume a firm consistency. Now we see Master Raymond execute a couple of maneuvers which essentially trigger reflexes that result in uterine contractions. It is essential to restore its firmness, which thereby stops further hemorrhage. Nipple stimulation has been advocated by midwives and natural birthing centers as a means to trigger labor by stimulating uterine contractions. This itself would not be effective if a maternal hemorrhage was severe and life-threatening. The other technique, which Master Raymond employs, is bimanual uterine massage. It is not a gentle maneuver. One hand is placed in the vagina, grasping the lower portion of the uterus, oy vey. And the other hand is placed on the abdomen, grasping the lower portion. Good Lord, that's like around the cervix. Good my freaky monkey. Vigorous massage is applied to the uterus. Oy. It is a technique employed by obstetricians, but by no means does it feel pleasant, let alone make any woman feel orgasmic. I certainly never heard any patient say it felt good in any way. Hemorrhage remains one of the top What?
Could you imagine afterwards? You give really good uterine massage.
Oh, summer.
Also, I think you've used that word. I think
uterine
I don't think
massage?
No, I don't think we've had the word vaginal used in any of our podcasts as much as tonight.
Go
second
Sarah.
Of all, I don't know anyone who wants a flaccid uterus. That just doesn't sound appetizing at all.
Hemorrhage remains one of the top three obstetrically related causes of maternal death, but today it is disproportionately a problem in developing nations, 99% versus 1% in industrialized countries. Various procedures, drugs, and supportive measures are combined to stabilize the patient and prevent further bleeding. Then Raymond tells her to, quote, call the red man. The pressure of his fingers and palms grew. She tried to fight it and then couldn't. Quote, the inexorable pressure went on, cracking the crystal sphere, freeing the chaos within. So we have lots of mention of stone in some way, especially related to Raymond, and now we have like the second or third reference to chaos, which is you can relate to her journey through the stones. Melissa writes, Raymond calls Jamie the red man. Interesting. Red, passion, fire, seduction, almost a polar opposite of blue. It is by bringing Jamie into this holistic healing, I'll let your medical expert dissect the healing, that brings about the complete healing, and it is when Raymond is focused on her womb. This is the center of her loss, not her heart and not her head, but her baby and her husband. That empty womb represents her empty emotion and empty family. Her baby is dead, and she has no idea where Jamie is. Forcing her to call out to Jamie is forcing her to miss him and acknowledge both her love of him and their loss. Claire's mind is filling with images, as with the cracking of the sphere. Her real grief must begin so that her healing can as well. Her spirit is flailing about. Quote, grief and loss and fear racked me, and the dusty scent of death and white chalk filled my nostrils. Casting about in the random patterns of her mind for help, she heard the voice still muttering, call him, and I sought my anchor. So Jamie is her anchor, and she knows how to stop flailing, what to grasp onto, whom to hold to get her through the chaos. She calls to Jamie. Diana writes, quote, "A bolt of heat shot through my belly from one hand to the other, like an arrow through the center of the basin of my bones. The pressing grip relaxed, slid free, and the lightness of harmony filled me." I'd never read these lines so closely before. What do we think happened? We know Raymond is a healer and that he was doing everything he could. But the infection in her womb, where the seat of her grief lay, was something she had to be part of to heal, no? By making her call out to Jamie, by giving her something to live for, to hold on to force her to fight for, to encourage her, he was encouraging her own healing powers as well as her spirit to heal and to fight. Ellen G. writes, "Why was the intonation of Jamie's name used to heal Claire? Are they so connected, body and soul, that without the other, they could not exist? And the fact that Raymond and Claire share the same aura color, are they part of a soul family connected through the ages?" Courtney writes, "The whole healing segment is fascinating. Raymond engages in the equivalent of 18th century orthopedics or visceral work, with some mystical thrown in. He basically does for Claire what Claire does for Jamie in season one after Wentworth. He knits her back together again on every level, physical, emotionally, spiritually, and he weaves Jamie in, knowing that he is inexorably linked to Claire's survival as a whole person. It's clear that Raymond is important to Claire." What about the line, "and the lightness of harmony filled me"? Isn't that beautiful? At first I thought that might be a title, but that's a little bit, like, too romantical. People come to see what was wrong, and Raymond barely hides in time. They feel around and examine her and find the fever has broken. Mother confirms this, covers her up with a sheet, and leaves. Raymond reappears but says he must go, again calling her Madonna. She grabs him, wanting to look for a vaccination scar, and she asks him, and he doesn't know what she means. Melissa writes, "She inspects Raymond for a vaccination scar. Claire is smart. She has noticed the connection between them too, and she heard the stones in their connection to him as well. He doesn't have one, which disappoints her, but since vaccinations only came into common use in the mid-20th century, I wouldn't discount him as a time traveler." Connie says that the passage is reminiscent of Claire's description of the suspension of time and necessity at the Abbey in Outlander from chapter 38, quote, "a place where all things were possible and none were necessary," and, quote, "for where all love is, the speaking isn't necessary. It is all, it is undying, and it is enough." And then in chapter 24, she says, in Dragonfly and Amber, quote, "it was though we were suspended together in a place where neither time nor consequence existed. There was room for nothing but truth between us." When she asks him why he still calls her Madonna, he says it's not because of her being pregnant, but because, like him, she too has a blue aura. And then he leaves, and Diana writes, "the gauze curtain fluttered briefly, and he was gone."
And that was his mic drop.
Yes. So the chapter opens and closes with gauze curtains.
Thick gauze curtains.
Yes. So separation, this chapter is neatly separated from those preceding and following it, and also dreamlike. So this is very reminiscent of her feverish dreams, the fantastic sights that she'd seen, and the aura, I guess otherworldly. So having this thing, this chapter, begin and end, so, you know, be covered by, be held together by, whatever, blocked off by, gauzy curtains. I mean, you can read a lot into that. It's like the veil of sleep, literally, sleep and dreams. I've never noticed that. You have gauze curtains covering, entering and exiting the chapter, going into it. So I thought that was very poetic and beautiful. Melissa writes, "her aura is blue as his, yet another connection between them. Does this mean Jamie's is red?" Connie also has some interesting ponderings regarding the TV series. "It will be very, very interesting," she says, "to see whether Dominique Pignon's cloak will be Madonna blue, i.e. ultramarine, or what Terry Dresbach will come up with." Courtney writes, "I do hope Ron's team will keep this short but impactful chapter, or set of scenes, in Dragonfly and Amber Season 2. There is so much to include, but this one is a gem, in my opinion." Ellen G. writes, "Wow, I loved this chapter, and while I am not a medical doctor, I believe myself to be a healer, and this chapter was right up my alley." Lisa T. comments, "Welcome, Lisa. This is her first time joining us. When Master Raymond is healing Claire, he is also teaching her how to heal, both herself and others. At the end of the chapter, it is almost as though Raymond gives Claire her doctor's lab coat when he tells her that her aura is blue like the Virgin's cloak. So from a place of devastating loss, illness, and pain, Claire is not only beginning to heal, but her own healing gifts are deepened. And finally, Melissa shares, "So this chapter closes with a sense of forward momentum. I'd say hope, but Claire still feels the sharpness of her loss. She isn't ill anymore. She isn't ill anymore, though, so she will recover. We are also left with many more questions regarding Raymond than we had before." So what did you think about this chapter? It was kind of short compared to the ones we've had the last few weeks, but, I mean, a lot of stuff happened.
Well, I mean, if you look back at the chapter, there's, like, literally three things happen. But each of those three things is described so fully that there were lots of descriptions to break down and tear apart and chew on for a while. So it was a good chapter. And it was right up Diana's alley.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my gosh. So the description, her writing, period.
Right. The scientific stuff.
Oh, and then the anatomy. Yeah. Oh, my gosh, yeah. So anything with Raymond, anything with Claire. Claire's
oh, my
Claire.
God. Can I just say I can't wait till we're not in France anymore?
So I don't have to say Raymond?
That, and so that I don't have to, like, struggle when we do the read-along portion, because I don't even want to talk when we do the read-alongs in France, because I know there's going to be a word that I can't pronounce.
What's the next chapter?
Next chapter is chapter 26. Fontainebleau. There you go. I don't know how to say
it. That was not bad, except, of course, the end is
yeah, I did
not
it on purpose. Rock.
I know you did. It was funny. It's the name of a
place.
It is a place. I think it's a castle. I have not been there. But I do believe, if it's not a castle, it's definitely a very, very ritzy residence. We'll look it up, and we'll talk more about that next week. So thank you, as always, for joining us, especially this very rich chapter, and thank you everyone who contributed. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/outlanderpod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at Outlander Pod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/Outlander Pod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.